say who are the chairman of these subcommittees and of the committees and
who are the staff people
and all that stuff that we could write to. You know, I don't know who they are.
The Institute for the Development of Indian Law, that's one of their jobs that they've got funding for, is to take workshops out to the tribes and sit there on the reservation and talk about the federal government system.
Thanks for giving me the job, speaking on bad bills. It's like when Bob McLaughlin led off this morning, he was saying it's nice to be able to have a well-defined topic to talk about. When Kevin asked me to come down here, he said, well, what do you think would be the most interesting subject? And we came up with the title of The Role of Congress in Indian Law and Policy. And that was my choice because it's such a nice, broad subject that you can pretty much cover anything. Kevin can't say I didn't talk about what I was supposed to. There's been some interesting points made today, and I thought I'd just touch on a couple of things and then go into some more specific discussion of the bills like the Cunningham bill and one that Chloe Meads has introduced. One of them is this question of the plenary power of Congress. It's kind of a unique, and to some who really first get into Indian affairs, a very surprising concept that Congress has the power, essentially, to do anything it wants about Indians. I guess that the most startling context where it arose is how it arose historically, when some of the Indian tribes were bringing suit to federal court, essentially trying to make the point that Congress cannot simply pass a law which would have the effect of abrogating a treaty. The legal theory that the tribes were trying to make at that time was that there is a superior quality to a treaty. There's been discussion about the nature of treaties so far today, and I think the most common understanding of enlightened people would be that a treaty is more than just a piece of paper. It has more of a binding force. There's more of a responsibility that the government commits itself to when it signs a treaty, such that a treaty should not be able to be changed by one side, that is the United States, simply unilaterally, simply by passing another law which has the effect of changing the rights which are accrued under the treaty. And when the Supreme Court dealt with that question, I think the first time they dealt with it, they tried to basically duck the question and saying, well, this is a political matter. You know, those of you, I know there's quite a few attorneys in the audience, and you know that that's a rather traditional way in which the Supreme Court ducks having to deal with an issue by saying, well, it's a political issue, it's not a judicial issue. And I think in every case where you find the Supreme Court or the federal courts taking that course of action, you can read behind what they're trying to say, and you can see that it's a question of definition. I mean, that by defining something as a political matter and thereby stepping back, I think what it does is it passes the buck back up to the political body of Congress. Well, the other stark example of where Congress's power in Indian affairs has been illustrated occurred about 50 or 60 years later when the terminated tribes brought some lawsuits against the United States, again asserting that Congress should not be able to simply pass a law and terminate the trust relationship. Terminate the relationship that exists between a given tribe and the United States and pass that law against the consent or without the consent of the tribe. And again, the courts concluded that Congress was free to do that. Congress has plenary power. And those of you who look at that question, it's very, I guess it's mind-boggling. So when we see a bill like Congressman Cunningham, which would purport to abrogate all Indian treaty rights, and under the guise of Native American equal opportunity, provide Indians a chance to be equal to everybody else in the country. I guess it's clear that there is a, I mean, if you examine the law and you know that Congress can terminate a tribe, Congress can break treaties, then Congress could abrogate all the treaties in one fell swoop. Well, those of us who have analyzed this Cunningham bill have concluded that Congress cannot abrogate all these treaties, that there is a limit to Congress's plenary powers, and that it would be unconstitutional for Congress to pass a law such as Mr. Cunningham proposes. I think it's unconstitutional because Congress then gets into the business of abrogating vested property rights as opposed to political agreements such as are manifested in the treaties. Or Congress, in abrogating all treaty rights, would get into the business of taking away rights which have been recognized under the law as opposed to rights which are in the nature of a privilege, that is, the kinds of services that accompany the federal-Indian relationship, services which are terminated in the termination legislation. So I think it's comparable, well, the constitutional block or the constitutional obstacle to Congress's being able to enact something like the Cunningham bill is under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment. Now, if this government stands for anything, it stands for the proposition that you cannot take away property without due process of law. And I think to attempt to legislatively take away the property rights of Indians, which are guaranteed under the treaties and under statutes, etc., to attempt to take away those rights in one fell swoop would go against due process of law. Now, Congress can attempt to rewrite or to change the status of the rights, say by a piece of blanket legislation, but they would have to give due compensation. That is, this is a fundamental aspect of due process. It's in the nature of when someone's property is condemned because you want to build a freeway or something like that. Well, Congress can exercise its eminent domain power to condemn an individual person's property, but they have to give them due compensation. So we did a little figuring on Mr. Cunningham's proposition, and we concluded that if Congress wanted to take away all the rest of the property rights that Indians possess in one fell swoop, then it would bankrupt the Treasury overnight, because they would have to give due compensation. And due compensation is not something that they can redefine. You can't say it's due compensation to give the Standing Rock Sioux $10 for the reservation. You have to give them fair market value. And if you add up the 50 million acres that Indians still maintain rights to in this country and try to wipe those out, wipe Indian rights to those out in one fell swoop, you'd bankrupt the Treasury. So clearly there are limits to Congress's plenary power. And those limits are shown, for example, also in the land claims legislation, or soon-to-be legislation. Some of you have seen, you know, who are members of the Indian Rights Association, and I understand that you've had the opportunity to talk with Tom Terrain and others on the question being raised by these land claims in eastern states claiming to be filed in the Indian Non-Intercourse Act. There's a peculiar nature to some of these claims. That is, there are claims being filed for recognized title, not just Aboriginal title. And that's the big difference. That's why these claims are being taken so seriously. Because Congress cannot pass legislation to abrogate the right to recognize title, that is, vested title, without giving due compensation. And again, you're talking about staggering amounts of money that they would have to pay. And it's in the nature of the political system that Congress is simply not going to appropriate $25 billion to pay one given tribe so that a legal claim to vested to a vested property right can be wiped out. So again, that's a practical limitation on Congress's plenary power. But despite the fact that we can find outer limits to the plenary power of Congress, nevertheless, it's still a very disturbing doctrine, and it's a very real doctrine in terms of the kinds of threats that it poses. Take Mr. Meade's bill. Now, we don't have the full text of it. I've looked it over, and, well, I should tell you the story. Senator Abrahs had us issue a press release when Congressman Meade was holding his press conference to introduce his legislation. And we had heard the day before that Lloyd Meade was going to make a big splash, you know, and hold a press conference and have, you know, TV there and all the media and explain, you know, the legislation that he was about to introduce. And so we chased Senator Abrahs down, and he said, well, let's get a press release together so that we can have that available, you know, during the press conference that Mr. Meade has. And so we did. You know, it was a real rush job, and ran off copies and ran down to the press conference and handed out copies at the same time. Mr. Meade was, I don't know if any of you have seen him in operation, but I think that, well, I characterize him as smug. You know, he was very pretentiously going over his proposals, and one of the reporters, he had explained his proposal, and he gave an opportunity for questions. And one of the reporters said, "Well, I have a statement from Senator Abrahs where he characterizes this legislation as warmed-over termination legislation with a social policy gloss. Could you care to comment on that?" And our friend Lloyd was visibly shaken. Of course, he got out of it. He's very fast on his feet. But it gave us some pleasure to be able to catch him off guard. But I think Senator Abrahs has a way of capitalizing something, and I think that's a very accurate description of Mr. Meade's legislative proposals. Warmed over termination legislation with a social policy gloss. He denies, of course, that it's termination legislation, but he does make much of the fact that it's an attempt to legislate a sound social policy. The crux of his legislation would have federal law clearly limit the power of Indian tribes on reservations to tribal members and to tribal property, and thereby limiting any possibility or restricting any possibility that an Indian tribe would be able to act like a real government and exercise jurisdiction over everybody who's on the reservation and over all kinds of property. That's exactly where Lloyd Meade comes down, is that his vision of Indian tribes is something like a cultural association as opposed to a real government. And that's what his legislation is designed, you know, to accomplish, is to define Indian tribes in that manner. I think that the effect of the legislation would be to place all Indian tribes in the same status that Oklahoma tribes have found themselves in for the past 60 years. Those of you who follow what's happening in Oklahoma, I think it's very accurate to say that there's a real resurgence of tribal governments in the state of Oklahoma. Now, the whole Curtis Act era, around the turn of the century, when the tribes were all but terminated in Oklahoma, was quite a blow, but the Indians there are slowly recovering from that, and they are now on the verge of attempting to establish real governments. And if the Meade's proposal were enacted into law, there would be no opportunity for any tribes to really function as governments. But that's that would be the sure effect of the Meade's legislation. And it's very dangerous because it's a very... One could make a pretty persuasive case that that's where Indian tribes should be. That is, that they should be allowed to exercise powers over their own members in order to continue to exist as cultural units, but that they should not be recognized to have real governmental powers such that they could protect the tribal citizens on the reservation from people who happen to be coming across. We had a talk with Frank Ducino, who's the my counterpart over on the House side. He's a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe and widely respected Indian attorney. He's special counsel to Congressman Udall for the Interior Committee and serves as counsel also to the Indian Affairs Subcommittee. And just the other day, we were talking about the Meads legislation, and this has been a very disturbing development. One is that his water rights, water adjudication bill, has been referred not to the Indian Affairs Subcommittee, but to Congressman Meads' subcommittee, which is Energy and Water, Energy and Power Subcommittee within Interior. It's clearly a very dangerous turn of events because Mr. Meads probably will have a little difficulty getting that bill reported out of his own subcommittee, and then it'll be up to the full Committee of Interior to consider the bill and whether or not they report it to the floor of the House. Frank is also saying that although, you know, there's no question in his mind, he would argue strenuously against holding hearings on the jurisdictional bill, that he was also sure that Congressman Meads would probably be able to prevail on the subcommittee chairman of the Indian Affairs Subcommittee on the House side and persuade him to hold hearings early next year. So we're looking forward to the fact, we anticipate that there will be hearings on Meads' jurisdiction bill in the House side on the subcommittee early next year. And you can guarantee that he will hold hearings on his water rights bill early in the probably late January, early February. So these are very serious propositions, as opposed to the Cunningham bill, which is something of a joke around the Hill. Everybody looks at that bill and says, that's fine, Jack Cunningham did that to make his constituents happy, but no one's going to take that bill seriously, as opposed to Mr. Meads' legislation, which I think has a very good chance of getting reported out of committee. Now, those bills have not been introduced in the Senate side. So, assuming even that they go all the way through the House or some version of them are passed by the House, this Congress is no longer going to be law because obviously it takes Senate action also. And I think you can be assured if it's referred to our committee that we won't be in any hurry to bring it up for hearings. In fact, I doubt we'll have hearings on it at all if it's referred to our committee. I wanted to touch a little bit about land claims legislation because we had a hearing on a bill which was intended to resolve the land claims in Mashpee, Massachusetts. And I think there's some very interesting things developed out of that effort. But before I get into it, I'd like to stop and see if anybody has any questions on Meads' jurisdictional legislation or water rights legislation. No? How many of you have even seen that bill? I mean, other than the copies that were passed around here. Well, I understand that the National Tribal Chairman's Association and the National Congress of American Indians intend to do a mailing to every Indian tribe in the country and all the organizations the first of this coming week, where they will send the full text of those bills along with a joint statement and suggestions for the tribal leadership to be contacting their representatives over this recess period to make sure that their representatives know where they stand on those bills. And that there will also be an analysis developed of the Meads legislation so that we'll attempt to translate into your everyday language exactly what that legislation is attempting to do. There was a question, though, and now at least it's believed. All right. the students here at Princeton or whoever, there's some very useful things that could be done right away. Number one, I think one could write strong letters not only to your own representatives, but to Congressman Udall, who's chairman of the full committee, the full Interior and Insular Affairs Committee in the House, and down the line to Congressman Tino Bonfaglio, who's chairman of the Indian Affairs Subcommittee, and right to the members of Mr. Meeks' committee. Now, if you have access to congressional directory, or you know, a list of the committee membership can be made available. We'll make copies available to Kevin if anybody needs that, but I think there are many places where you can get a list of these committee members. So I think that whoever can write to the members of the Interior Committee in the House with special appeals being made to Chairman Udall and Ron Colio, that will definitely help. Simply explaining, you know, your opposition to the proposals. I think one of the basic points to be made is that Congress should have been past the time when they're trying to legislate on basic Indian rights over and above the objections of the Indian people. You know, we've gone through a pretty sordid history in this country, the way the United States government has treated the Indian people and has high-handedly dealt with Indian rights. You know, we should be in an era right now where the federal government is not in the business of abrogating Indian rights or passing legislation which has a very direct impact on Indian rights against the consent of the Indian tribes. Well, let me go into this land claims legislation. I'll tell you how it came about. You know, you've all been aware that these claims have been filed this past year, over the past couple of years. And everyone who takes any kind of a look at these land claims, you have to conclude that they're not going to go to trial. For example, the Passamaquoddy claim for upwards of 6 million acres, $25 billion in back damages, and so on. If the federal government simply sat back and said, well, this is just a lawsuit, you know, the Indians think they have some rights, let them pursue their claim in court, and we'll let the court decide what to do. Well, that doesn't work that way, because for one thing, the United States has been ordered to represent the Indian tribes as trustee. So you have a posture of the United States suing the state of Maine and individual landowners in the state of Maine on behalf of the Indian tribe, essentially to recover the land back, land that is populated and has been populated by the families who live there for generations. So simply to allow that court proceeding to take its own course is something that just can't, you know, they just won't let that happen. So once you conclude that these land claims just can't take their course, because you're talking about probably 10 years of legislation where title to property is clouded during all that time, and where everyone who lives in those claim areas has the threat of their property being suddenly taken away by an action of a court, knows that's not the way it's going to work. So all of these claims are going to be the subject of legislative settlements. Now, you have to understand that the Indians are bringing their claims under a federal law, the Non-Intercourse Act, which says very clearly that there can be no transfer of Indian title without federal authority. And in fact, that's the basis for the claim, that the Indians entered into transactions or through any variety of ways lost the title to land, and that there was not the stamp of federal approval on those transactions. Therefore, those transactions are null and void. Well, so at this present time, in 1977 or 1978, to have the Indian claim to that title change takes federal action. I mean, that the law still applies. Passamaquoddies could no more attempt to sign away their claim to that 6 million acres and have it have any effect without federal involvement than they could 200 years ago. So it's absolutely necessary that there be a federal stamp of approval, and that could take a variety of ways, on the transactions which will resolve these claims. So, understanding that, then it's been clear to the parties involved, not only to the attorneys for the tribes, but the attorneys for the state and the attorneys for the other defendants in these actions, that there has to be a legislative settlement of these claims. And it's been clear to the federal government, to President Carter, to the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, to the Justice Department, to the Interior Department, that it's going to take a legislative settlement to resolve these land claims. All right, so everyone has been operating on that sort of ground rule. Our committee, and the committee on the House side under Congressman Udall, have added another ingredient. That is, there's a standing policy that has been committed to, that has been adhered to by the Senate committee and by the House committee, that they will not consider legislation which would be designed to wipe away the rights of the Indians without their consent until there has been a showing of a good faith effort to come to a fair settlement of the claim. Okay, so that's a standing principle that the committees have operated on. Now, that hasn't stopped people from introducing legislation which would attempt to wipe those claims out against the consent of the Indians and without any attempt at a fair settlement. But that legislation hasn't gone anywhere today. Now, we've had several bills referred to our committee, and if the committee takes no action, nothing happens. They're just a piece of paper. So anyway, against that background, the claim in Mashpee, Massachusetts, by the Wampanoag Indian Tribal Council, went to trial. And trial is going on right now in Boston, the Federal District Court. And it's a complicated claim because of a lot of different factual situations. But there are about 1,400 to 1,500 households within the claim center. That is, individuals who own property as individuals and use that property as a household. I mean, it's a resident. In addition, there are anywhere from 10 to 20 development companies who own tracts of land which they are trying to develop because it's on the Cape Cod and it's a valuable development area. All right, the Indian, the tribe, along about September, amended their lawsuit to waive any claim to the land where private residents were situated. Now, they did not waive their claim to damages associated with the fact that they haven't possessed this property for all these years. But they simply have said in their lawsuit that they will not attempt to eject the people from their residences. In other words, they will not lay claim to possession of the residence. Right, following that move by the tribe, Senators Kennedy and Brooke and Congressman Studs, whose district that is, sat down and they drafted up a resolution, different in nature but the same effect as a bill, which would attempt to have the United States, by this act, extinguish the tribe's claim to those plots of land where they're private residences. And when Kennedy introduced it in the Senate, for example, in his statement accompanying this resolution, he made it clear that he did this to relieve the burden on those homeowners who had been within this claim area ever since it was filed. To relieve the economic burden upon them, and it was also premised upon the consent of the tribe to this action. So we had the tribe willingly giving up their claim to the residents and saying, we don't want to put people out of their homes, our main interest in this lawsuit is to stop the development. You know, this is Mashpee, this is where we've lived all this time. We don't like the way it's turning into some Cape Cod resort community. We want it to stay the way it is while we file this lawsuit. All right, so the resolution attempted to be a very narrowly defined, very simple proposition. It was about a page and a half. It simply said, you know, under the Non-Intercourse Act, Congress resolves to extinguish any claim that the Wampanoag Tribal Council might have to these resident areas, which is amounted to about, I think, about a fifth of the total area that they were claiming. And so anyway, that was introduced, and the Massachusetts delegation communicated to our committee and to the House committee and said, look, this is emergency legislation. There's a trial going on right now. We have people in that claim area who own homes who cannot even get a mortgage on their home, can't get a loan to build additions to their property. Some of them are poor old ladies who have been advised by their doctor that they should go live in Florida or someplace, but they can't do that. They can't sell their home because this lawsuit has been filed. And no bank is going to accept that property because there's a cloud on the title. So to relieve, you know, this hardship, please consider this emergency legislation and besides the tribe consent. So there was a hearing on the House side, and we held a hearing about 10 days later to consider this bill. Well, the House hearing was first, and it was sort of predictable. I mean, the Congressman Stutz came in and testified before the committee and made somewhat emotional and rhetorical appeal to the committee to please consider this legislation and please act on it right away. Try and get this done before Congress goes home this fall. And then, very interesting, the federal government was asked to submit their views on this resolution. And usually when the committee in Congress asks the federal government for their views, for talking about Indian legislation, the Secretary of Interior or the solicitor, you know, the head legal officer or the assistant secretary or, you know, one of the officials in the Interior Department comes down and testifies. Well, instead of having the Interior Department testify, we had OAB, a fellow named Adia Tucker, who was head of the Natural Resources section in the Office of Management and Budget. And the committee remarked upon the fact that, you know, this is a rare honor. You know, here is OAB, you know, in person testifying. And Mr. Tucker explained that the administration had decided to have him testify because they felt that the Interior Department would be in a conflict if they were to testify on this bill, because they were being asked to consider to represent the tribe as trustee, and they were considering the petition of the tribe, and for them to also comment on this piece of legislation would be a conflict. Well, be that as it may, they opposed the legislation because they said, if the tribe establishes that it has a recognized title to these private residences, a vested title as opposed to simply an aboriginal claim of occupancy, then by this act of taking that title as proposed in this bill, the United States undertakes a taking of the property in violation of the Fifth Amendment and would owe just compensation or fair compensation. And since the taking would be in 1977, the value of the right would be valued according to the values of 1977, and you're talking about potentially $150 to $200 million worth of property. So the committee, you know, was puzzled. You know, they sat down and they reviewed all the facts, and they said, well, I guess that's right. That's the correct analysis of the law. I mean, the United States cannot simply take away that right here now today without being liable for the fair value of the property. So OMB was saying, we oppose this legislation because we will not support something which will expose the United States to that kind of liability, $200 million. And so their proposal was that the tribe should have to pursue its claim in the court and establish that it had a recognized title to the property, and then OMB would be in favor of a piece of legislation which would extinguish the claim in exchange for a settlement offer. That is, so here's the difference. If the Congress passes a bill and wipes out the property, they owe the tribe what that property is worth today. But the alternative is Congress passing a bill which says, we will give the tribe X amount of dollars, or X land, X amount of dollars, and in exchange, the tribe will waive its claim, and then this bill will put the stamp of approval on what is basically a settlement. So, I mean, that's a standard out-of-court settlement. Anybody files a suit in law for some property that they own, and rather than take the suit all the way to its conclusion, both parties agree that they will settle out of court, and that ends the lawsuit, and they both sign on the dotted line, and that's the end of the matter. So that was the position of the government of OMB. So if we oppose this now, we're in favor of the tribe establishing their right in the court, and then we would be in favor of legislation which would settle the claim out of court. They didn't say how much money they'd be willing to pay to settle with the tribe, but it was understood that it would be in the range of about $500. And of course, the tribe came in and said, well, look, if we take our claim all the way through the court, we'll sit down and settle with you, but we're not talking about $5 million. I mean, because if our claim is a good claim, it's potentially worth $200 million, and you're telling us to sign on the dotted line for $5 million, it just doesn't make sense. So that was the end of the House hearing. The next stage of this drama was to have a hearing over on our side of the hill. And we went through the same machinations, but we were dealing with Kennedy staff people as opposed to dealing with Congressman Studs. And what we did with them is we said, look, it's clear that this resolution is never going to go anywhere. I mean, the OMB is going to oppose this, and if we even report it out of committee, everybody in the Senate who considers this bill would say, look, what this does, it exposes the United States to $200 million, they will agree with OMB and I will pass this resolution. So why don't we just call up the tribe and say, look, how much would you be willing to settle for right now without having to go through, you know, 5 more years of court action? And the tribe said $4 million. So we wrote a bill, you know, for Kennedy's people, which essentially said, well, okay, this bill is enacted in accordance with Congress's power under the Constitution, and it's based on a policy of fair dealings with the Indian people, and this bill is premised on the Indians' consent, and in exchange for their waiving their claim against the private residence property, Congress will give them $4 million, essentially. They will sign on the dotted line, and that'll be the end of the claim to the private residence, and the claim continues against the rest of the property that is owned by the developers. And I think the thing that we wanted to do with the bill was that the bill will obviously establish a very important precedent. All of these land claims, in fact, when we had people from Rhode Island, from Narragansett that filed a claim, people from South Carolina, people from New York, they were all calling us on the phone, the committee, and saying, what's going on with the Mashpee bill? Because they all understood that this would be the first land claim that Congress would act upon. And the way Mashpee went, that's the way the rest of it would go. And of course, OMB understood that. And OMB didn't want to have anything passed which would be overly generous, you know, to the Indians. And in fact, their preference would be to give the Indians practically nothing. Anyway, so we understood the precedential nature of this legislation, and our attempt was to write it in such a way that we would have the best possible precedent. So we wrote in language like, this bill is based on a policy that Congress will not abrogate any rights without Indian consent, et cetera, et cetera. And that basically the tribe agreed. You know, it's a fair deal, $4 million. We weren't going after that property anyway. And $4 million is just a symbolic figure. And in exchange for that, we will, you know, with consent, waive our claim to the residences. And so we had the hearing in. Brian came in and testified and said, yeah, I support that. OMB came in and testified and said, no, we can't support that because if we give this Indian tribe $4 million and they haven't proved a thing in court, you know, then that's bad policy. And anybody else who wants to file a claim and plow title to people's property and turn around to the government's going to pay them off. Elliot Cutler met with us, you know, outside of the hearing, and said, look, it comes down to, you know, our position is that we will be giving in to blackmail, you know, if we support this bill. We think that any Indian tribe who has a land claim has to establish a significant court action before we will support a settlement of the claim. Well, it was interesting because they took that position before our committee, and we had Senator Everest, our chairman, and Senator Benzenbaum from Ohio, as a member of the committee, and Senator Hatfield from Oregon, sitting on the committee, and then Kennedy came up and sat with, you know, with the committee for a while, too. And the reaction of Senator Benzenbaum was especially interesting because here's a man who doesn't know much about Indian affairs. He comes in and he listens to OMB's testimony, and he's saying, let me get this straight. What you're saying is that the only thing you will support is if the tribe essentially wins its lawsuit, and then you will settle for $4 million. Your lawsuit is worth upwards of $200 million. See, that simply doesn't make sense. So anyway, OMB, you know, that Mr. Cutler was a little red in the face, but you know, that's their position. Well, the whole thing, to make a long story short, we wrote the bill, and we went up to Boston and sat down with the tribe and with the representatives of the defendants, that is the town, the political leadership of the town. And we tried to satisfy both parties, but we couldn't. So then the next day we consider a bill to have what we call a markup session. That is not a hearing. The committee sits down and get a quorum of the committee, and they sit down and vote on the bill. So we had a markup session on the Mashpee proposal, and Senator Everest, you know, turned to the town and said, can you support this? And they tried to equivocate, but it came right down to it is that they said, you know, we really don't find this acceptable. Well, the catch to it is that the people he was asked, he asked this question of were the political leaders of the town who were developers. So they couldn't support this bill, which would take the private homeowners out of the lawsuit, let them off the hook, and leave them in the lawsuit. You know, despite the fact that, in theory, you know, they were responsible for the individual citizens of the town of Mashpee and not to the developers, especially. But anyway, that's just a quirk to the whole situation. That's why Mashpee is such a difficult one to resolve. But Senator Everest basically said, well, look, you know, we're not going to impose a settlement on anybody. We're not going to impose it on the tribe. We're not going to impose it on you, the defendants. So the bill died right there. And now they're still in trial. I expect the Mashpee trial right now is just on an issue of the tribe standing to bring this lawsuit. If the tribe wins that issue, then they go into the trials on separate issues. And I mean, if that trial continues, it will be 5 or 10 years. But everyone assumes that if the tribe wins this round and perhaps the next round, there's absolutely no question that they'll get a fair settlement out of the whole business, and that they'll never go the full length of trial. Well, anyway, that's the story of the land claims thing, and I just thought I'd share it with you because it's interesting, all the underlying kinds of considerations there. And the reason that we on the committee are so concerned about the land claims, just trying to line it up here real briefly. This is history repeating itself. I mean, here we are in 1977, soon to be 1978, and Congress is faced with the same basic propositions they were faced with in 1900, and 1800, and 1700. How shall we deal with the Indians? Congress, in these land claims, has an opportunity to deal with the Indians fair and square, or it has an opportunity to repeat history and essentially attempt to take away their rights and leave them nothing. And it's a real test. I mean, it's tempting for Congress to try and find some way out of this, some way other than passing legislation which gives living in tribes fair value for their land claims. But we'll see what happens. Any questions?
So there is really no immediate resolution for that. Probably
going to
end up a
deputy's
legal
business. Well, no, see, the situation is, in all of these land claim areas, you've got Maine, for example, you've got something like 6 million people who own homes within the claim area. In Mashpee, a much smaller claim, you still have something about 3,000 people who own homes, 1,500 households. In New York State and Oneida, the same situation. Catawba suit in South Carolina and Narragansett suit in Rhode Island. In every one of those areas, you have individual homeowners